Esther 9, verses 14 to 16. And the king commanded it so to be done, and the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. The Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day also of the month Adar, and slew 300 men at Shushan. But on the prey, they laid not their hand. But the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives, and had rest from the king's enemies, had rest from their enemies, and slew of their foes 75,000, but they laid not their hands on the prey. As the work of that day of battle has come to its conclusion here, king, we saw in previous verses, sought to have a report brought to him, keeping him informed about the day's events. He wanted to know what was going on. None of this was to be done apart from him. He is, in fact, the great civil authority, and he wants to know exactly how this decree has worked itself out. Now, this is actually, I think, unlike the decree of Haman. With regard to the decree of Haman, there's no indication that the king had any particular interest like he's exhibiting here. But here he's exhibiting very keen interest in the outcome of this second decree. And again, I would say that this is suggesting to us that the king has, in fact, had a genuine change of heart toward the true religion. It's not certain exactly what part, right? If not toward the true religion directly, then certainly it is by proxy, because he's had this very changed demeanor and change of heart really toward his wife Esther. And through her, at the very least, through her, the faith of her fathers. So as Jesus points out in Luke 9:50, we might well say the Ahasuerus, even though we're not entirely sure where he's been and where he's going, we might say unto him, "Forbid him not, for he that's not against us is for us." But I think it does bode well. And how could a man who's been brought up in the Persian religion, you need to understand this, when you were in that royal succession, you were, in fact, your entire life was being tailored to succeed to the throne. So you not only would have been schooled in the arts of statecraft, but in the case of the Persian Empire, you would have been very much required to be a member of the religion of the Persian people. Sort of like we still see in the British nation that the queen or the king, they are not allowed to be anything but members of the Anglican Church. They have to be members of that. It was something very similar to that. That's very old world. And in fact, I would say not only is it old world, it will probably be very much like that during the millennium. Anyway, what could have brought about this sudden change in his attitude? A change where he changes directions to favor the faith of his wife without himself having at least some kind of shift in his mental or spiritual demeanor. It's hard to imagine that he hasn't had some kind of change of thinking and change perception as to what's going on. Of course, everything here, as I've noted again and again, everything here points to the unmentioned God, whose presence is everywhere implicit in the book of Esther, and yet it's nowhere explicit in the book of Esther. We see God working in mysterious ways behind the scenes, if you will, but the results of it are, I think, remarkable and unmistakable. Now, the shift in the king, if we're not really sure what to make of it, I think we can see it's further to be noted in the king's response once he's been told of the carnage inside the palace complex. I think it's relatively obvious, if you understand the nature of court intrigue, the king would have understood that allowing Haman's sons to remain alive, particularly within the vicinity of Shushan, that would have been to allow a potential rivalry between them and the Jews to continue indefinitely, and that might have sucked his throne into danger. Right? It not only would have been distracting to Mordecai, who's his new vizier, his new prime minister, but it would have also left the door open to possible coup attempts, I think. If you consider the positioning, likely, Haman's sons are probably ensconced in higher places of power and trust, and if they should, for whatever reason, I mean, they probably have some very good reasons, personal revenge, they might decide secretly to align themselves with some foreign power. So it's not really the best in the wisdom of statecraft to allow people at that level to remain close to the throne, within your walls. It's like having a fifth column, you know, an enemy within the gate, potentially. So although I would say, obviously, he's not going to be too distressed by the news of the fate of Haman's sons, what is interesting is he's equally nonchalant about the deaths of these other 500 presumed officials who've been slain by the hands of the Jews. Now, if he was really fearful about where this was taking his kingdom, if he really thought that the Jews had political aspirations, if they were that they were perhaps a threat to his throne, hearing that they had killed 500 men in a single day within the walls of the fortress at Susa, that should have been enough to set off the alarms. After all, if you think about it, had that degree of slaughter occurred apart from his permission and pleasure, it would have undoubtedly been met with a tremendous counter-exercise of royal force, which would have been designed to blunt the opposition and to remove the perpetrators from the kingdom permanently. To the contrary, interestingly, Ahasuerus reacts to this report as a king who appears to be taking sincere pleasure in discovering that this second decree has been effective not only in destroying the legacy of Haman, but to some extent in promoting and promulgating the claims of the true religion, that of the Jews. Again, although some have seen the killing of Haman's sons as an act of pure vengeance, some commentators have found Esther and the Jews' actions in this book as being entirely opposite to the spirit of the Christian faith. I would suggest it not only does it not seem to be the case, but we see elements of mercy throughout. Remember, the decree had actually allowed them, if they wanted, to kill the women and children of their enemies. And it doesn't really appear that they've done that, certainly not those who are within Shushan, as we already saw and as we're going to see. They seem to be limiting themselves to those who are men, and again, to those who very clearly have expressed themselves in ways that show themselves to be enemies, open, hostile enemies to the Jews. You know, they're a real and present danger. Think about the case of Haman's sons. If Esther had wanted to, she probably very simply could have wished to dispose of them. She She might have actually asked when Haman was being taken out to be hanged. She might have just said, you know, by the way, can we hang the sons with him? And it's very doubtful that the king would have turned down a request at that point. It wouldn't have been, in terms of Persian politics, it certainly wouldn't have been outside of a reasonable request, what would have been considered a reasonable request. Instead, what she does, however, she waits to see what the sons of Haman are going to do. Right? They've seen their father's been hanged. They've seen and heard this second decree. In doing that, Esther demonstrates, in fact, that she is much more just. And we could say this of Mordecai as well. They're much more just than Haman. Remember Haman? He had consigned the entire nation of the Jews to destruction over the act of one man. But she won't even though I would suggest to you that royal statecraft at the time certainly not only would have allowed this, but would have in fact counseled putting the sons to death. But she's not going to put the sons to death for the sins of the father unless they've first been given an opportunity to show themselves to be the same stamp as their wicked father. So during this intervening time, these sons actually had an opportunity of doing several things that would have signaled their surrender to that change that was being wrought throughout the kingdom with the elevation of Mordecai. There's several things they could have done. First, they might have come forward and declared themselves now loyalist to Esther and the Jews by converting to the true faith. Remember, there were a lot of people throughout the empire who did convert. So it wasn't unprecedented. It wasn't as if it wouldn't have been accepted. In fact, if you recall in Genesis, when Simeon and Levi, when their sister is deflowered by a heathen, they go to him and they say to him, well, you know, if you want to marry our sister, what you need to do is you need to be circumcised. They ask him to take upon himself the sign of the covenant. And so while he and his entire family circumcise themselves and thereby make themselves proselytes to the true faith, Simeon and Levi come back while they're in pain and slay them all. And we're told explicitly that was a very unrighteous thing they did. Right? The Jews couldn't have killed the sons of Haman if they had converted to Judaism. It would have been an act of supreme unrighteousness to have taken them in that way. But the sons of Haman didn't do that. But that's one thing they could have done. A second thing they could have done is they could have left the city of Shushan for parts unknown. And they could have done that. They could have left. They were given an opportunity to flee. And that would have demonstrated they had no further desire to continue the conflict. They weren't interested in trying to set up an opposition or to man the his majesty's disloyal opposition, if you will. They don't do that either. A third thing they could have done is they could have petitioned for mercy and simply feigned submission to the king. Or they could have thrown himself at the feet of the king and said, look, we surrender, we don't want to be Jews, but we're not going to resist what you're doing. But it appears that they bothered to do none of these things, and that is why I think undoubtedly it made them a threat. Not just a perceived threat, but it, I think, speaks volumes that they were a real threat because they stayed in the capital city. And the only reason for staying was, at this point for them, probably hoping or thinking that they, on that appointed day, would be able to overcome the opposition of the Jews. That they had organized better than the Jews. And that would make them a peculiar and special target for the Jews on that appointed day. The fact is, by remaining there, not only have they declared that, but we have to understand, for Haman's sons, unlike perhaps other people in the empire, they didn't have the option of remaining neutral on the sidelines. You couldn't be a child of Haman and remain neutral. A lot of people, they were able to sit on the sidelines to see how it would play out. But of all men that day, it could not be assumed that they were neutrals. And that's always a problem, by the way, for the children of people who were involved in any kind of great, tumultuous chain of events, whether it's in church or state. You know, the children of those who are at the forefront are going to find it very hard to remain neutral. They're going to array themselves on one side or the other. They're going to have to, or they're just simply going to get run over in the course of the conflict. Now, while the king does seem eager to do what's right, he is also here equally eager to avoid doing what's wrong. And I think that's important. He doesn't presume to know exactly what to do in this situation. And so, having received the report of what has happened, he turns now to Esther for counsel. And he does so knowing her close ties to Mordecai. So although he's asking Esther what she thinks is right to be done next, or what she desires to see done more, he should also realize, and I think that he is probably a man wise enough, he has to realize she's not acting on her own initiative, but she's speaking in accordance with the counsel she's received of Mordecai. And if she's not sure where that counsel goes, she's going to consult with him again. So it was noted in an earlier verse that Mordecai was becoming a greater and greater man in this kingdom, while the house of Haman and the influence of Haman is being rooted out. The king's questions and offers then to continue to grant her whatever she finds lacking displays in this context not only a sincerity of mind, but I think it also points to a singularity of purpose. He wants to see that the divine will is being enacted throughout the kingdom with regard to the matter of justice. And that's appropriate. He is, in fact, the chief magistrate of the Persian kingdom. He's a king. He's not courting counsel from the mouths of heathen oracles any longer. What he's seeking, if we keep in mind the typologies, he's seeking the wisdom of the ages from the mouth of Esther, who's a representative or type of the true witnessing church of God. And Ahasuerus understands that justice is not going to be done until and unless the true God has expressed his satisfaction with the outcome. Now, what that tells us is Ahasuerus actually understands justice is not defined by a subjective appeal to one's own conceits or to the tyranny of electoral majorities or some sort of ruling class. He understands justice is defined by an objective divine law. And that's very contrary, isn't it, to the way men presume to exercise authority over men today. But Ahasuerus, in this, very clearly, I think, appears to understand justice is not going to be determined by any kind of majorities or subjectivities or anything else other than the Word of God. He now understands the need for that input of divine revelation. Before we move into our verses, lastly, I just want to point out here as well that we should understand Esther herself, when she makes a response to the king, we should be very clear about this. She's not responding from her own wishes. She's not putting forth her own whims or her own desires. I know it may appear that way when the king is asking her, but we should understand that her response, again, she's a type of the true church established by law, the witnessing church. Her response represents a due consideration and a proper application of the Word of God in that present situation. Okay, so what she's done is she's taken that which has been revealed and she's made these principles something intelligible in her response to the king. She's made those principles applicable to his needs. So she's drawn those principles out and she turns that back to him and gives him what he needs to do his job. Now, as I've already noted before, her answer to him begins with a request for more time for the Jews to pursue their war against the wicked who are still within the city of Shushan. When she makes that request, as I hinted at last time, I think she's demonstrating she really does understand the difference between the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. She's concerned to see that not only the letter is observed, but that the spirit of the law is as well. Because the spirit of the law actually pertained to establishing genuine justice. Now, why is that important? Well, justice is one of these things that you really don't have simply by observing the letter of the law. Right? If it doesn't reach to the spirit of the law, observing the letter is nothing but a mockery. But by asking for a second day, she's suggesting that sometimes stopping at the letter of the law will actually destroy the spirit of the law, particularly when there are matters of justice that also have wrapped in them concerns for mercy or necessity. You see, continuing the fight is both necessary and merciful to those who would suffer if they should cease their hostilities simply at the end of that one appointed day. Should certain enemies be allowed to remain unmolested by the reach of the real justice, then justice really hasn't been done. Now, additionally, Esther here calls for the public display of the bodies of Haman's sons. And by doing that, she shows that she understands that the purpose of public justice is only served when the ends of that justice are actually kept public. Star chambers, secret courts, private executions do not serve the broader interests of public justice. Secret justice serves only the narrower interests of victims or their families. Now, I don't mean to imply that the interests of victims or their families are unimportant in this equation of justice. But what I am asserting is that the failure to publicize the justice that has been meted out tends to make all punishments that are enacted take on the character of private vendettas rather than serving the broadest interests of our society. It's the swift and public execution of justice that actually serves as a warning to others and makes the wicked to fear. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 8:11, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Swift justice is good justice. Public justice is real justice. When we are considering societies. I say that in part, you know, it was a big mistake to limit public executions in this nation to private death chambers. We need to go back to public hangings and things of that sort. The purpose is the public purpose is only served when it's done publicly, and it serves a purpose within the community in which the crimes have been done to show these malefactors suffering for what they've done. And Esther understands this. She's not content to allow their bodies to be buried quietly. You know, these are people who are intimately connected to Haman, and she's going to make sure that they're put up there with their father on this gallows. All right, so with that, let me turn to these verses. The king commanded it so to be done, and the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. So right away here in this verse, the king commanded, we're reminded of the centrality of the king to all that has transpired so far in our narrative. Right, the prospects of peoples have risen and fallen with the mood and disposition of the king. That's the nature of living under a despot. Right, in the Persian Empire, nothing could be sure without the king's concurrence, and nothing could be allowed to stand against the king's desire. Now, the Hebrew here notes simply the king said, but when we consider that this is in response to Esther's request, which is laid before him with those words, if it please the king, it takes on the force that the translators have used here. The force of the king saying is that of command, because really consider, first of all, he's the king. Right? Second, he's acquiescing to the request of Esther, and he's turning that petition into another decree. And third, he's now apparently speaking to some of his courtiers to put all of this into effect. So we're reminded in this, again, of something that Solomon notes in Ecclesiastes, and that is, there is authority in the word of a king. The king is now acting like a king. So when he speaks, he's speaking like a king, and that's a command. When the king tells you to do something, it's not just a suggestion. It's like if your father tells you to take out the garbage, it's not just a suggestion if you're a child. The king commanded it so to be done. Here's the nature and gist then of the new decree. The Hebrew says thus, for it to be done thus, in this fashion or in this manner. That is, in the manner that Esther has requested. In other words, the king is appropriating the desire of Esther and simply transforming it into the next thing on the list to be done. So here is a king who's moved by the words and concerns of his wife, enacting them as they're his own, precisely because they do now seem good to him. So she's told him what she thinks, and then said, if it seems good to you, do this. And by his response, what he's saying, without saying it explicitly, but what he's saying is, it does seem good, and I'm going to add my authority to that. Ahasuerus is consenting to rule according to the sayings of Esther. And in that, he is typical of a magistrate who lives and rules in a nation or a country under the light of the gospel, the light of special revelation. Here he has the light of special revelation declared before him by the church established by law. That's what Esther represents. It's interesting. He's not concerned to rule apart from righteousness. But now he sees that the security of his reign is actually best served by securing what is just and consonant with the true religion. Now he knows what the true religion is. He must take that into account. It's part of his political calculation. So here then is renewal permission given royal sanction. What the Jews had done on the day, earlier in that day, is allowed by this decree to continue throughout the city complex on the following day. This is not a blanket permission for the rest of the kingdom, but it is for the city of Shushan. The king commanded it so to be done, and the decree was given at Shushan. By noting that the result of the king's speaking was issuance of a decree, by which is meant that unalterable law of the Medes and Persians, that's the word that's used here, we can see clearly his speaking is not in some unofficial capacity. He's speaking to give royal authority to the desires that Esther has expressed to him in her response. What we have here is a picture of this. When the church is established by law and the state is in covenant with God, there is this convergence to uphold the true religion. And legalities respecting the support and defense of the true faith are enacted in this way. Not without respect or the counsel of the church, but with the concerns of the church clearly before the chief magistrate. So he is demonstrating exactly what a national establishment should look like in reacting in response to her counsel. He's asked her, she's given a proper interpretation and application, and he in turn gives that his royal sanction and authority so that it becomes a legality within the kingdom. Here the king then, after requesting counsel of Esther, again the established church, he moves to see her concerns for righteousness, her concerns for justice, are being reflected in the laws which pertain to the outward administration of the kingdom. He's not meddling in matters of faith, but he is supporting the true faith in outward matters which concern the faith. He's lending royal support, countenance, and defense to the true religion in the Persian Empire, particularly within Shushan here. So with a wave of the hand, the king would have sent out word quickly into the city so the Jews in Shushan could be prepared for the next day. This has to happen quickly. Right, last time, they had sufficient time to send out messengers everywhere to see that the Jews were prepared. Now, that the decree was given at Shushan underscores, I think, the authoritative nature of the command given. Should be remembered, Shushan, Susa, means lily. And that in the thinking of the Hebrew people, the Jewish people, this reference is tied to the celebration of the Passover. So, what bespoke the center of authority for Persian, Shushan, actually should have been a constant reminder to the Jews of their deliverance from Egypt. Right? If they had heard this with ears of faith, they would have been hearing deliverance, whereas the Persians just understood this as a source of authority. Here, more deliverance flows from this very unexpected source. But in the Song of Solomon, the church is described as the lily among the thorns, on the rose of Sharon, and the lily of the valleys, and as the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Song of Solomon 2:1-2. By the way, there is that song, and probably a lot of people today have been singing that in order to celebrate the pagan Ashtoreth holiday, the Easter holiday, in the churches. And a lot of them will sing a hymn where the words are of Christ, that he's the lily of the valley. That's to confuse the church and Christ. And that just goes to underscore the fact that they are very good papists in their theology, and another reason why you should never trust a hymn writer to write your praises. But the lily is a symbol of the church. And in Shushan, Esther, who is the church, is in fact the lily grown up among the thorns. Right? The thorns remind us of the curse upon the ground because of man's sins. But despite the curse, the church is growing here in Shushan. And the church is a wellspring of hope. And when it becomes established by law, the leaven of the gospel hope is then allowed to permeate civil society, and it is supported throughout the empire. And they hanged Haman's 10 sons. Now, although already dead, as I've indicated, these sons, who in life had been in solidarity with their father against true religion, true faith, they're now going to be made symbols of the triumph of the Jews and their religion. And we see here Esther's request with regard to the 10 sons is granted specifically in this clause. We see that it's there. Why is that important? Well, in ancient culture, Herodotus, Xenophon, Plutarch, all of them record incidents which demonstrate that hanging someone on a cross was regarded as a sign of disgrace. And we know from some of these accounts that among the Persians, it was not uncommon to inflict this as a further mark upon enemies who'd been killed in some other way. So if you wanted to disgrace someone additionally, you might have killed them on the battlefield, but you dragged their bodies back and then hang them up on a cross. The Targum tells us that Haman's body occupied the top 10 cubits. Remember, it was 50 cubits high. And then each son was hanging over the course of about 3 cubits and separated by 1 cubit each, altogether making then 40 cubits, which reached the height of 50 cubits. Now, at that time, this would have been particularly, I think, disgraceful, because at that time, people still had a concern for disgracing the family name. They should have this concern today, but it seems like that charm has worn off a bit. But these people would have been very much disgraced, and it would have caused horror to flow over not simply a few of the members of the family. The Chaldee paraphrase says that Zeresh, his wife, upon seeing these 10 sons being hanged under their father, that she gathers 70 other children that he had, according to the tradition, and that together they spend the rest of their days begging bread door to door. Remember, the Jews are very, very much interested in showing that these descendants of the Amalekites had been thoroughly disgraced. And so the idea of saying this is that they want you to understand any hope of the rising again of the house of Haman has been destroyed. That means no one else should even bother seeking to try to help them with any imperial ambitions that might be expressed. So another reason then for hanging them was, as I indicated earlier, to strike terror in the hearts of any who would have remained of Haman's party. Now, if we missed you, just to let you know what's going to happen to you if we catch you. Now, seeing these sons hang would spread the fear of the Jews throughout the city of Shushan. And again, it would declare the doom which awaited anyone who desired to follow in their footsteps. They weren't above the law. It caught up with them. What makes you think you're going to get away with it? So, the next verse. The Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day, also the month Adar, and slew 300 men at Shushan, but on the prey they laid not their hand. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together. That was without much forewarning. The Jews around Shushan were already of a different caliber, perhaps, than the Jews throughout the rest of the kingdom. They're quick to respond to the new decree. Now, although the English says, for the Jews, Hebrew simply has a common conjunction, which often means and the Jews. To be understood, then, that the king didn't make the decree to cover the Jews, having already acted, but rather his decree has moved them to this act. Specifically, what we're being told here is that they gathered themselves together in order to exercise this peculiar privilege now granted by the king. The verb used to describe their gathering is used in the context of gathering throughout Scripture for purposes of war or for purposes of worship. Although we might be tempted to think these purposes are quite different, if we consider the nature of Israel being typical of the church, these two concepts are actually not at odds. You see, when we assemble to worship God, we are engaging in spiritual warfare. You may not think that, but how many people struggle simply to stay awake, simply to pay attention, simply to be forward to hear what's being said? People are easily distracted. They're easily drawn aside to thinking about the things of this world, to let their minds wander. Israel's warfare typified this spiritual warfare. Now, in addition, when Israel went to war, we need to remember the first tribe that they sent forth into battle was Judah. And Judah's name means praise. Judah was always sent first in the battle whenever Israel set forward. We see that in Numbers 2, verse 9. All that were numbered in the camp of Judah were 100,000 and 80,000 and 6,400 throughout their armies. These shall first set forth. Assembling as a church then means praise. And praise is that hot tip of the spear in spiritual warfare. Receiving the word of God, hearing that word and allowing it to penetrate is that first thrust of the sword, the spiritual sword. Furthermore, we should understand this to speak of the Jews around the city rather than those in the palace or fortress itself. Right. These Jews are outside of the palace. They are the Jews, if you remember earlier, they were very receptive to the orders of Esther and Mordecai throughout this whole conflict from the first rise, even before Esther petitioned the king. When she fasted and prayed, they, together with Mordecai, fasted and prayed with her. Those are the Jews who've now been mobilized. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day also, the month Adar. In Matthew's Gospel, we see the genealogy divided into groups of 14. In the first month, the month Abib, the 14th day of that month is the Passover. 14 is a number which is associated in Scripture with deliverance or salvation. Now, I've already discussed some possible reasons for allowing the second day. The best of which, I think, is that it is demonstrating to the Persians that this is not a matter of miscalculation on the part of Haman, that God's people can kill them any day of the week. Right? Should God, in fact, unleash them to do it, he will empower them to do it. And so it creates a little bit more a sense of foreboding in those who want to remain in opposition to the church and people of God. But if we consider this 14th day, the second day, in connection to this theme of salvation, its spiritual significance suggests that we're to understand these events as pertaining to something more than a fleshly battle between Jews and Persians, or as the rabbis suggest, between the Jews and the seed of Amalek. In fact, the rabbinic suggestion also should make us contemplate that what's being recounted has a very deep spiritual significance. Now, the use once more of the Babylonian name for the month Adar reminds us that the Jews are finding themselves in this terrible predicament precisely because of their sinning against the Lord, specifically their penchant for committing idolatry. You know, another reason why we don't celebrate pagan holy days, right? We don't want to be caught up in that idolatry, what it brought to the Jews. Their deliverance is being affected in contrast after they've been re-engaged to worship God according to his commands, specifically through prayer and fasting. So on the 14th day also the month Adar, and slew 300 men in Shushan. So in addition to the 500 slain in the palace, we're now told of another 300 killed throughout the city. Again, the use of the word man, ish, is denoting one who is male, suggests that they're only killing men, not women and children. And I would say it also suggests these are represented in a singular fashion, somehow connected to the political machine of Haman. Now, if you were a Jew hearing the number 300, might have reminded you of Gideon's 300 who defeated the Midianites. Remember them? But here are 300 who are unable to do anything to stand against the onslaught of the Jews. Now that's interesting. Because the number 300 is also the numerical value of Ruach Elohim, the Holy Spirit. And it's the Holy Spirit who came upon those men who assisted Gideon in his rout of the Midianites. So here are 300, and the spirit of the Persians is unable to withstand the spirit of God. That's, I think, something being hinted at here in numbering these people. I'm not saying there weren't 300 of them, but I think that the Jews are going to hear this and be reminded of a very different situation. So the Jews have no like deliverance as Gideon and the 300. In fact, on this second day, they're getting what is sort of like a double portion, like Elisha. And it's unlike the other Jews. So there's something, I think, a little bit prophetical about the spirit and character of these Jews in Shushan, which I'll come back to in a moment. Those who declared themselves enemies of the Jews were to be dispatched, especially those dwelling in the city of Shushan. Now these, like those in the palace, had most likely been placed in positions, as I said, by Haman. They're probably part of his political machine. What they represented then, if we understand, if you remember who Haman was and what he represents, they're the remnants of the previously established Persian religion, the established heathen or pagan religion. And they need to be purged out. Though they've been established by law, they need to be gotten rid of. And now, the church, though the church is now established by law, The church has no right just because it has the political protection. It has no right to allow herself to become an engine of political intrigue. And it has no right to harbor men there for political reasons. The church is not allowed to engage itself directly in statecraft. The second day would assure the cleansing of the temple so that the true religion could have its full establishment. So the Persian king is going to be positioned to receive instruction and counsel from principles of true faith, not mingled with the old heathenism. It's not going to bubble up in some bad admixture. But on the prey they laid not their hand. Again, and importantly, we're told the Jews didn't lay their hands upon the prey of their enemies. Not interested in the spoils of the enemies of the true religion. They're not motivated. Remember, they're not motivated by political calculations. They're not motivated by concerns for personal gain. It's a fit reminder here, then, to the heathen all around them. They're not doing what they're doing for filthy lucre's sake. They're driven by a desire to see the honor of God and His truth being vindicated, as well as a desire to see the welfare of their fellow believers preserved. Now that is in stark contrast, by the way, to the machinations we saw with Haman. Haman thought nothing to offer money to the king for the destruction of the Jews. There's nothing about what they're doing that would be understandable. The general ethos of ancient pagan people believed that to the victor go the spoils, or at least to the king of the victors go the spoils. But if the Jews didn't seek their goods for a prey, it would be one of those things that those who hadn't sided with their enemies, those who'd survived, but not yet become Jews, it would give them reason to pause and consider the spiritual motivations of the Jews in this matter. What they're doing is very much unlike anything they would have seen before. But the other Jews, they were in the king's provinces, gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew of their foes 75,000, but they laid not their hands on the prey. The other Jews. In this verse, the narrative is reverting back to the storyline which we found in the first several verses of this chapter, wherein we were told of the great slaughter throughout the kingdom on the 13th day of Adar. For this reason, the conjunction has been translated "but" to indicate a shift in focus here. And it's, again, it's the same conjunction. It could have been "and," but in this case there is clearly a shift in focus. By other Jews are meant those who were scattered throughout the empire, not those found in the city or those found in the palace of Shushan, as will be clear in the next clause. But the language here and going forward suggests, I think, that there were two kinds of Jews. There are Jews associated with Shushan, and there are other Jews scattered throughout the kingdom. Now, if you remember something I suggested several weeks ago, which is this. Esther is not merely a type of the true church established by law, but she's actually the witnessing church established by law. And that might help explain the subtle distinction that's being noted here, all right, between the witnessing church and the rest of the church, between the two witnesses who are maintaining a public testimony for the truth of God, and the 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to Baal, who are scattered and unknown. They're Jews, but unlike the Jews in Shushan, they hadn't spent a second day purging out the remnants of the old heathen religion. So just keep that in mind. But the other Jews, they were in the king's provinces. These other Jews were believers, but they, unlike their brethren in Shushan, they're scattered throughout the kingdom. Right? The Jews in Shushan are all kind of together in one place, and it has a name. They're the lily of the valley, the lily among the thorns. But these are men of faith who were moved by the example of Esther and the prophetical commands of Mordecai. They're not unbelievers, and they're not nominal Jews. They have real faith. They're like the 7,000. They haven't bowed the knee to Baal, but they're not really concerned for the degree of purity that the Jews in Shushan are. They're quick to avail themselves of the remedy which has now been presented in the second decree. Right? They're not friends. They're not supporters of Haman. They're not friends or supporters of the false religion of the Persian fire worshippers. None of that. But I would like to suggest that their scattering throughout the kingdom does suggest that when they had been brought into the Persian kingdom at some earlier time, they had studied some other interest rather than the glory of God. They'd allowed something else to get ahead of that, especially if they had scattered themselves, right? If they had done this themselves, then it looks like they had consulted worldly wisdom or some sort of earthly advantage over the advancement of the true religion. Seems like the more zealous believers are all congregating in one place in Shushan. Through this scattering, we discover with the decree of Haman that they're in a very weak position. And through weakness, they had almost perished. It's only through the providence of God that they're made to feel the weakness and perhaps the foolishness of their dispersed condition. They were unable to be edified together, and they were unable to help one another effectively in this condition. And in all of this, in this scattered condition, the devil had gained a tremendous advantage over these scattered Jews. The other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together. And nevertheless, then when their enemies were discovered, when their position and the weakness of their position was exposed, they're moved by the exigency of the times to gather themselves together. In fact, if you remember, it was the second decree which had required them to do so. And that decree was issued at the behest of Esther and Mordecai. Here then we see a great advantage of having an established church, particularly when the church is the one embodying the faith of the witnessing church. These others are gathered, at least outwardly, they're gathered through the support of the king. And the royal command adds civil sanction and authority to the command of God, which warns them they need to gather themselves together and not to forsake the assembling of themselves together and so on. They gathered themselves together and stood for their lives. So having been gathered together, these other Jews are positioned to make a defense, to stand for their lives, or as the Hebrew says, for their souls. And that seems about right. In gathering, there is a setting up of that necessary defense for our souls, and that's what these Jews now had. When they were scattered, they were in danger of falling prey to their enemies. In their gathering, they, and the root of the Hebrew verb connotes this, all right, the word that's used for stood, they become like a pillar. Right, that word for stand actually in its noun form would be used to describe a pillar. And isn't that what Paul says of the church? It's a pillar and ground of the truth. Right, they stood as those who are knit together in the true faith, bearing witness against every false thing. And by doing so, they're protecting not only their own, but one another's souls. They stood for their lives. And they had rest from their enemies. So their offensive strategy, we're told, led directly to their place of rest. And the word rest, again, carries the sense of finding a place of quiet. And if it had been preceded by suffering, this word rest, it often carries with it the idea of a place where the suffering has been removed. So they've been united now under a banner of truth in defense of the true religion with a concern for justice. And they find that uniting in this way is actually preservative for the soul, and that it's an effectual means of providing shelter from the assaults of men of wicked and perverse judgments. They realize that they have, in fact, become unassailable in their unity. Now, it should be remembered here, the enemies of the Jews are in reality enemies of God and the true religion. This story in Esther is not about personal conflicts. Nothing personal. It's really just another episode in that grand story about the ongoing battle between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Right? The church is either professing and prevailing, or the church is departing and failing. There are no two ways. Right? The church can't stand still. When you're standing still, you're actually, in terms of the Christian faith, going backward. You're either going forward or you're backsliding. Standing still is backsliding. That's why we can't ever get to a point where we say it's enough, right? We can't ever get to a point where we say, well, we're religious enough. We've sanctified ourselves enough. We have become good enough Christians. People who enter into that mindset are backsliding and apostatizing. But interestingly, these Jews had rest or peace before those in Shushan. Right? They had it first. That it tends to be the way. The 7,000 didn't bow the knee to Baal. I'm sure they had rest before Elijah did, didn't they? You know, they're in a cave and they have prophets bringing them food. Elijah, on the other hand, he doesn't really get rest until he's taken up in that chariot. They might have had rest before the people in Shushan, but they never had rest apart from the Jews in Shushan. Because they would have never had that second decree apart from the Jews in Shushan. And apart from that second decree, they would have never gathered themselves together to fight back. The fact is this, throughout the history of the church, those who have clung to the faith in its purest, in its most consistent form, even though they've always been very small, they have exerted a disproportionate influence over the rest of the Christian church. They've influenced the church in ways that people still don't really fully understand. Presbyterians today, wherever they are on that spectrum, don't really appreciate or understand how much they owe to a few thousand men and women who were willing to be martyrs for the faith during the killing times. And even in the 20th century, we saw in the formation, when Dr. Machen formed Westminster Seminary in 1929 in Philadelphia, that seminary exerted a disproportionate influence over all of evangelicalism, not only in the United States, but around the world, simply by remaining sound. And I'm not saying they were sound on all of the points where I would have liked to have seen them sound, but when it came to the defense of the Bible, they were, and that, in fact, leveraged a position that preserved a lot more of the church. So what's the difference between the Jews in Shushan and the rest of the Jews, the other Jews? The other Jews followed the letter of the law, fighting only upon the 13th day of Adar. But the Jews in Shushan pursued the spirit of the law, and they fought on a second day. That's the difference between the witnessing church and the rest of the church. We're not saying they're unbelievers, but we're saying they always stop short. They're content with being corrupted and corruptible. Their place will never be sure. It's the duty and it's the place of the witnessing church to maintain a testimony that is consistent regardless of the opposition. We need to pursue the spirit of the law, not simply the letter of the law. Finally, we're told they slew of their foes 70 and 5,000. So the Jews outside of Shushan, it said they managed to kill 75,000 of their foes. Remember, they're doing this because they've been leveraged by the witnessing church in Shushan. Right, this slaughter. Now, if we recall that 810 men had been killed in Shushan, the fact is that number doesn't seem out of proportion. They're simply enumerating the casualties throughout the remainder of the kingdom. And by the way, again, whenever this number was related to Ahasuerus, we don't really know, but there's no record of him reacting negatively here. He must have known at some point, but there's nothing of that. It might seem, as many commentators note, that life was just cheap in the Persian Empire and he didn't really care. On the other hand, it might actually be viewed as a very small number in comparison with the spiritual mercies which are now being proclaimed throughout the kingdom. Remember, that body count represents almost certainly the most obstinate and vile idolaters whose ambitions would have stopped at nothing short of destroying the people and the church of God. These are not good people. And again, we read, but they laid not their hands on the prey. So this is the third time we're told in the narrative the Jews did not lay their hands upon the prey of their enemies. It should be clear, they had not killed for mercenary reasons. They had not sought riches or temporal favor in what they were doing. It wasn't why they were doing it. This was strategically defensive, and it was merely intended to eradicate those who were prone to violent opposition to the true faith. They weren't simply killing people for disagreeing with them. They were killing those who were predisposed to being willing to kill them if they had the opportunity. It was defensive. Now, once more, I would point out the Jews were, in this respect, not laying hands on the prey. They're repairing, if you will, that spiritual sin of Saul when he took the plunder and the spoil in 1 Samuel 15. When he took that from the Amalekites, and then he failed to destroy Agag, the Amalekite king. They're repairing that, if you will. And they're continuing really to imitate Abraham, the father of the faithful. Again, in Genesis 14, he refused to take any reward from the king of Sodom, lest anyone afterward should say that the king of Sodom had made him rich. And in doing this, the Jews are showing themselves to be wholly dependent upon the true God for the security into the future. Not only have they not taken any of the spoil of their enemies, but as we're going to see, this action that transpires over these 2 days, one day throughout the whole kingdom and a second day in Shushan, this action is actually going to set the stage for a very liberal and generous positioning of the Jews with regard to their neighbors in the Feast of Purim. In conclusion, we should note that it's very important for us to seek unity. But that unity must also be in the truth. Unity outside of the truth is actually a conspiracy against the truth. And that's what Haman had prior to the conversion of the king and his support of Esther and the Jews. To that end, then, we should consider that the unity which spread throughout the empire began as a unity held by Esther and Mordecai, two witnesses, who as public witnesses for the true religion, they didn't soften the edges or distort the message. They didn't try to adapt their message to their audience. They just gave them the raw truth and told them they had to suck it up. All right? You can't allow the truth to be watered down, no matter how bitter it seems to those who have to drink it. Instead, as opportunity arose, they were careful to set the claims of the faith before the king. And they don't trim. It's through the instrumentality of the witnessing church, then, that the rest of those who wouldn't bow the knee to Baal were brought to gather themselves together unto the truth and its defense. And that's what will lead to that revival. It will lead to the millennium at the end of the age. So may it please the Lord then to grant us the grace to be faithful witnesses, regardless of the tumult we may see arising throughout the kingdom and empire in which we find ourselves today. Amen.